I like how TK was so humble and was like, I don't know, in the Expo in 1986 or 1967, and that was the exact year of the Montreal Expo, of course.
Okay, well, I was not certain. You know, the neurons in this head, you know, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
Welcome to Travel Stories with your hosts, Tom Kim and Trevor Mountcastle. This episode, we have something special. We haven't had two guests at the same time since episode 8. So it's been quite some time, and even better, we have the same two guests. Jeff, Joey, welcome back to the pod.
Welcome, hello, welcome.
Everybody. Hey, everyone. Thanks for having us.
So we've tried to do trips from time to time, and unfortunately, it's been a while since we've been able to get a semi-epic one. And I think this was the epic one that we were able to make work over Father's Day weekend this year, going to none other than the greatest city in Canada and the home of the Montreal Grand Prix.
I'm not 100% sure I'm willing to say it's the best city in Canada. So I'd like to not put my name on Montreal being the best city in Canada. I don't know how Trevor, or I don't know how
TK's going to feel
here. I think that was TK's observation here, wasn't it?
Yeah. I think it is my favorite city in Canada. I've spent a lot of time in Montreal, and you know, I like visiting it. And I like the restaurants there. I like the city.
I mean, it's great if you pretend Vancouver doesn't exist, I guess.
You know, I love Vancouver. It's a nice city, but you know, I don't know. It's a good combo for me, especially in the summertime.
Yeah, I haven't spent enough time in Vancouver. I sort of said greatest city in Canada, more tongue in cheek, as I think, you know, we sort of agreed as a little bit of an inside joke. Not to get in the weeds, but I was expecting a little bit more European influence, and I felt like it was really European light, lighter European than, like, some had sold it as, like, Singapore being Asia light and Montreal being Europe light, and it was nowhere near that. So I mean, an interesting city to see. Let's not perseverate on that one, and let's get to the real reason why we were there.
Well, real quick, before we get off the rails with Montreal, breaking news for some people here, just for you Hyatt fans out here, which I'm assuming a lot of people are here. The Shangri-La is no longer the Shangri-La, and it has converted to a Hyatt. It's Category 7. Right now, it is called the Hyatt Vancouver Downtown Alberni. And in 2026, it will be reopening as the Park Hyatt Vancouver. So all the more reason to love Vancouver, I have to say. But it's interesting. We're getting a new Park Hyatt in North America.
Hey,
it's a solid hotel anyways, mm-hmm. Or it was at least.
Well, that is your non sequitur moment. Talking about a city on the opposite coast of the coast that this podcast was about. But interesting to hear that there's going to be a new Park Hyatt in North America. And Vancouver, nonetheless. A lot of people enjoy Vancouver. A lot of great connectivity out of Vancouver to Asia and otherwise, Australia as well. So, you know, could be an opportunity to knock two birds with one stone. So let's get back to Montreal. The way a Formula One goes, and I am not expert in this, so I'm going to ask if Joey or Jeff, can you guys walk us through just sort of the sequence of events, right? Like there's a practice, then they've got to qualify. There's a lot of different things that are happening on these tracks. I always had this perception that it was, okay, they get X number of time to practice, and then like nothing else is happening on the track. And then they qualify and big to do for an hour, and then like it's boring, and then, you know, then you have the race. But there is so much more happening at that racetrack.
Yeah, I think especially now that F1 was sold and is now owned by an American company, for those people that don't know, that's called it's a company called Liberty Media. I think they're making far more of an effort to commercialize the sport, much to, I'm sure, most Europeans' dismay. You know, Liberty Media is the ones who brought Drive to Survive, which is another reason a lot of Americans know about the sport. But you're right. So from the Formula One cars standpoint, there's two practices on Friday. Then there's one practice Saturday morning. Then you have qualifying Saturday afternoon. Then you have the race Sunday. And then there's quite a few support races. You've got the women's series, which I can't think of what it's called at the moment. F1 Academy, right? I think it's F1 Academy now. W Series is gone. You've got like Porsche Carrera Cup. You got several other series that just kind of help you fill the day so you're not sitting out there for 3-4 hours with a dead track.
And it's interesting. This is like every day has a different ticket, it sounds, it seemed to me. And if you want to sort of have a cool experience for practices or qualifying, you can pay up for that, you know, sort of bougier experience, maybe a better view, maybe drinks, maybe some food. And then maybe you can go a little bit cheaper for the actual race if you're trying to be economical. But it sounds to me like there's a lot of different levels, so to speak. You want to talk a little bit more about that? I feel like you guys have done a fair bit on the different ticket styles.
Yeah, I think that's probably more of a me thing, just being comfortable with tickets and rolling the dice a little bit. Generally, if you're not a diehard F1 fan, I think the best thing you could do anywhere you go to F1 is go on Friday or go on Saturday and buy the nicest ticket you can afford. And then generally, you can buy a $300, $400 ticket on Saturday that'll probably be in hospitality with nice food. Now, this doesn't count for U.S. races, but anywhere outside the U.S., generally, that's the price you can walk in. That same ticket, for example, on Sunday would be like $1,000, $2,000. So if you're not actually like really into it for the race, more for the experience, you can definitely, like you said, Friday for sure, for pennies on the dollar compared to Sunday, get into the nice seats. Friday, I think, doesn't really have as much value, but Saturday's nice. You get to experience qualifying. All the cars are out on the track at the same time. You guys came right on Saturday, so you got to experience that.
You described Trevor and I exactly. So we did exactly that.
Exactly. Yeah.
I'm assuming a lot of the listeners too, right, are not going to be diehard F1 fans. I do think it's a cool experience for everyone to go see. I actually think Montreal logistically is probably one of my favorite tracks I've been to, and I've been to 8 or 10 races now. Montreal's unique where you're on the island and you feel kind of far, but you're still really close to the city. And I think Jeff's also been to some different races, so he could speak on how he feels, I guess, about logistics-wise getting to the track.
Yeah, I was surprised. I thought it was going to be a bit of a nightmare in Montreal being on the island, but they really got a system in place for both buses, cars, or taxis, the subway, even the ferry to get back and forth that worked pretty smoothly. I mean, we took pretty much every method of transportation over the course of 3 days, and even walking, there wasn't a whole lot of difference getting back and forth. To your point, Trevor, it's nice there's a variety of access options. You know, even not going into Joey's world of buying individual tickets and getting complicated in that aspect, but just walk up box office, everything from general admission to, you know, $20,000, $30,000, $40,000 for the weekend. It's kind of, you can have any experience you like at an F1 race and curate it to your desires or your budget. And then with a little bit of extra effort or thought, like Joey said, you can piecemeal your individual day tickets and you can really have a great experience for one day just to experience kind of the real high life show, and then just hang out with GA and hang out with fans and do whatever on race day for a lot less.
So well said. So let's dive into this specific experience. So I missed Friday, but I think Tom, you might have gotten up there on Friday, and I know Joey and Jeff, you guys were there. Walk us through your experience on Friday for practice day.
I arrived on Friday, but you know, I didn't make it to the track. I just met up with these guys for dinner that night. So, and then just did a little bit of wandering in the city prior to that. But, you know, Jeff and Joey talk about their experience.
Yeah. So I had the most convoluted, probably, way of getting there. I found 15K American Airlines space into Toronto. So I took that in business class. And then I spent the night at the JVD hotel in Toronto, which is pretty decent. I would stay at the Park Hyatt given the choice again, but the JVD was nice and it's in the same little neighborhood. It was less points. And then the next morning, I finally got to fly to Billy Bishop, which was very exciting. And I took an Air Canada Q400 to Montreal and then hoofed it in a taxi cab from there to the Hyatt Place where we had our lovely accommodations. If you are going for F1, I think the Hyatt Place still even had space the week of the race, which I thought was crazy. And they were asking 900 Canadian a night at the time. And it was just available on regular point. I mean, we all managed to get rooms, right? It's pretty easily. So,
yeah, I think it was a 3-night minimum was the one challenge that I had. But TK and I bunked up and that worked out well. Thank you, by the way.
It's a great location, too.
You're welcome.
It felt very convenient, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously not the most glamorous hotel or, you know, but from a cost per point redemption, it was great. And I don't think there was, I couldn't find any Hilton, Marriott. There was really no other point options anywhere available in the city. About 9 months out, the Centric also had some space, but by the time we actually got around to planning this, it was full. But I think the first day, Jeff and I walked out of the hotel, you go a block over, we hopped on the subway, took the subway to the track. Yeah, just kind of hung out for the day. We were in hospitality on Friday, which was okay. And to be honest, I actually liked our seats on Saturday the most. It didn't have hospitality that we're supposed to, but, you know, a whole nother story for another day. But the seats
you
that
mean
we actually sat.
So you mean, when you say hospitality, that means it comes with food, right? Food and drink?
Where our grandstand was, in front of the grandstand is the start-finish line. So when you go by in the race, you see all those big tents. And there's really just tables with hospitality is essentially like not seats. You kind of just have like tables or imagine like a really corny convention at like a DoubleTree just hanging over the track, which the downside is there's no seats, like no seating, and everyone's on the same level. So like when the race starts, everyone just kind of stands up and you're like, oh, can I see? Or you got to like fight your way in and like hang out at the side for the day, which if we were paying full price for hospitality for the weekend, I would have been pretty annoyed. We ended up getting some pretty cheap tickets. Like,
but we got to ride on the pontoon boats all day long.
We did get to ride on a pontoon boat, but I mean, we got over 50% off sticker on hospitality, so hard to be that upset. But I mean, if we had paid retail for those, I could see being a little annoying. The food and beverage was fine. Jeff might remember what they had wine and beer wise, but like they catered all the food from the Fairmont in Montreal. It was okay, but it was nothing I would like go out of my way to eat for sure.
It was definitely better than many other races, I will say, as far as F&B, both selection and quality, at least compared to other F1 races I've been in hospitality in. But it is. It's nice, or, you know, it's upper mid-range wedding food. It's nothing that's going to really blow you away.
I was going to mention that the racetrack, I thought the environment itself was very nice. You know, it's on this island, I guess, that at some point, I forget when it was, 1967, I don't know when the Montreal's World Fair was, but, you know, a lot of the buildings from that expo or World's Fair are still there and are part of kind of the environment. And, you know, it's a nice park, you know, that to visit Montreal when there is an F1. And it kind of added, I thought, a little bit to the race to have such kind of a pretty environment.
And it was actually pretty cool. As we were walking by, I think you were commenting about that. And there was an older gent that said that he had come to the World's Fair when he was a kid, as we're like walking away from on qualifying day. And it was just one of those things that felt to me like it just really hammered home. And not to distract from the point, but after Tom, you and I left here, we went to the Osaka World Expo. And so it just felt like there was just a little bit of a connection.
A thread.
You know, of the two cities. A thread of the two cities.
I like how TK was so humble and was like, I don't know, in the expo in 1986 or 1967, and that was the exact year of the Montreal Expo, of course.
Okay, well, I was not certain. You know, the neurons in this head, you know, sometimes they work and sometimes they don't.
The interesting thing is that humongous ball that you saw that we walked by a couple times that looks like the Epcot Center ball, I guess I remember looking it up when we were bored. I was flying home later. That was actually the U.S. Pavilion.
Oh, it was. Okay.
World's Fair, yeah. And it had a
big
monorail.
Geodesic dome.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's like some sort of like environmental museum, you know, zoo kind of thing now.
I was going to say, I think it's part of the zoo.
I didn't even know they had a zoo on that island.
Yeah,
they must not have been happy. Those animals must not have been happy with the F1 race.
I think it's more like a kind of like a aquarium environmental kind of ecosphere kind of thing. So it's not exactly a zoo.
Yeah. Right. I think that thing is technically called a biosphere now, right? Like, yeah.
Okay. So let's get back to this. So practice day, hospitality suite, not the most amazing, it sounded like. I got there late on Saturday for qualifying, not by choice. I had one of those fun experiences flying where you have to literally use every tool you have in the toolbox to get where you need to go. It included having to having to go originally starting at like 5 a.m. at Reagan and then having to hop a Uber at no notice to get over to Dulles.
I'm glad you got it out of your system. I didn't have to experience it with you.
Yeah. Because it was a guy's trip, of course, there was going to be, you know, some sort of a challenge. I think I took the pain for everybody. But you guys had been able to start the day right at the racetrack for qualifying day. So walk us through that, because I think I only made it for the last bit of it. I think I made qualifying, but there was, I suppose, a lot of other stuff that happened before.
I'm curious to hear your perspective, TK, as your first F1 journey.
I didn't know what to expect. You know, again, I was kind of impressed with the environment. I thought our trip out there was pretty seamless. I think, if I remember correctly, didn't we take an Uber to the area where the shuttle buses were? And correct. So we did a little bit of a wait there. Not too bad. You know, I thought it was pretty reasonable. I did think the walking was a lot more, and that was a theme of the entire weekend. I think there were lots of steps had by everyone. The grounds are massive, you know, and different stands, like you mentioned, there's like a price point for pretty much anybody's budget. So, of course, there's so many different kinds of places where people sat and different ways that they sat to enjoy the race. We actually had really great seats. I mean, you guys had secured something near the chicane, right? And we're near a big display where they were kind of, you know, broadcasting and showing kind of the race and, you know, one of the curves. So we had really great view of the action, so to speak, and definitely felt like when we were in the qualifying round, you know, I definitely felt like we were right in the middle of things.
If I could just dovetail with that, the walking, I actually really enjoyed, but I totally get that it was a lot. It was a ton. I came in probably the same way that we came out almost via that same bridge. The seats that we had, I was really impressed with, because last time I'd just been to a race, I'd been to Daytona 500 and like you could just walk in for practice rounds way back in the day. I don't know if that's still the way. I feel like they've monetized that so much more now, but we're talking like 20 years ago. The seats that you guys had for us, number one, you have that curve. Is that what is called a chicane? I mean, it effectively felt like you had a little bit of that curve, and then you're doing almost like a 270? Am I wrong? I'm seeing odd looks at your guys' face, whether the turn has a specific name. But while you're trying to figure out how to answer me there, the thing I thought was really interesting is that here you are, number one, you're undercover, so you're not in the sun. Number two, you've got this big screen and a speaker that you can actually understand. And I don't hear as well as most people just from years and years of loud noises. And so to be able to watch the qualifying on the screen and then to be able to see them come right by us, for me, felt like a multimedia experience, like, you know, both with my own eyes and being able to see on the screen. And I don't know if that's standard with everybody. It looked like looking at the other side, they had much smaller screens. And I don't feel like you get the same experience, but be curious to get your guys' opinion. Am I giving it more credit than it's worth, or was that about as good as it gets?
They're pretty good seats. I forget the name of the grandstand we were in, Joey, but you're on the inside of the track, inside the kink on the start-finish straight. And so you're looking right at the turn one and two kind of complex, which is like a left and a long right. And I don't recall if it's got a name or not, but the view from there is probably about as good as it gets at that track. And it's probably one of the better grandstands in F1, at least from the half dozen or so races I've been to. The shade is really nice. It's the only grandstand at the track with permanent shade. So that's a huge benefit, I thought. And then like Joey mentioned earlier, compared to hospitality on Friday, especially in Montreal, because the main straight, the start-finish line, has a kink in the straight, you really don't see a lot of the action in the first corner from the suites. Whereas the seats that we were in, like TK said, you know, with the view and qualifying, they're right in front of you. Everything's happening right there.
Yeah, they have to slow down for that S curve, which I think is a chicane, right?
It is a chicane. It's called the Senna S. And yeah, it's called the Platine Grandstand. And I would say if I ever went back, that is 100% where I would stay, if you could find some great seats there. And those are some of the only padded seats. And it's the only seats with shade. And it's one of the only seats with television there. So it's definitely worth paying a little premium. I think the one downside is they don't have private bathrooms, which in hospitality, we had private bathrooms, which were next door. But there, it was like you had to walk 15 minutes to go pee, which I found very annoying as a person with a small bladder.
And the lines were not exactly short.
Yes. And so I looked it up for you, Trevor. Coming down the front straight, they are hitting, before they get on the brakes, they're hitting 315 kilometers per hour, which in freedom units, for those of you listening in America, is 196 miles an hour.
That's pretty incredible.
Thank you for the conversion.
Yeah. No problem. I'm going to segue, not on the speed, but I'm going to segue on the facilities. The interesting thing that threw me off was how enormous they had different food trucks, they had different stands, but my gosh, it just felt like just this slog to try to get there, to try to get any food at all. I mean, I could totally see enjoying that hospitality experience, even if it's, you know, kind of mid-grade wedding food, over having to kind of stand in line and everything. I mean, I felt like at one point we got down to that little lake and we were trying to figure out what line was for food, what line was for the wine, and they just intermingled and you just couldn't tell much.
It was a scrum.
Although the food was pretty good. It was definitely good. Felt like a scrum.
And you know, the other interesting thing was they were okay with you bringing in some of your own beverages. Like we had brought in some of our, I brought in my Diet Coke, you guys brought in some Perrier. I had brought in some food as well to kind of tide me over for the majority of the morning. And then, of course, you know, unfortunately, you know, when they're not racing around the track, you know, that's when everybody is seeking out stuff, including bathrooms and facilities and, you know, lines for food. And they were quite long and quite unorganized. So I went in line for one of the food trucks that were around the lake area, and I felt like I was in line probably a good half hour, maybe, at least that's what it felt like. So, but I was very happy with the food I got, and I thought it was not like super overpriced. It wasn't like Las Vegas strip prices. It was, and it probably also helped that, you know, it was in Canadian dollars and not US dollars. But I enjoyed my, you know, box of wings that I bought, and I think I got you some sort of chicken sandwich or something, and it was reasonably nice. Not ridiculous.
After the travel day I had, that was probably the best chicken sandwich of my life. I'm just going to say. You know.
And you got like fries, like poutine, right? For, I think.
Yeah, the poutine was pretty good. With meat. Like, yeah, it wasn't a bad price. And, you know, like TK said, it's nice, especially being, or I guess it's more common in the non-American races, non-US races, being able to take in your own food and beverage. Non-glass, non-alcoholic, etc. But it does give you that opportunity to kind of take some snacks in to avoid the crushing rush right when a session ends and everybody else wants to eat.
And that's an experience you've had. Jeff, you've been to many overseas as well, and you feel like that's a fairly consistent rule?
Yeah, I think I've seen that at pretty much everyone. Australia doesn't allow you to. The races in the US that I've been to don't allow you to. I'm not sure what you've seen, Joey.
I think everywhere I've been outside the U.S., even like Monaco, which is a place you wouldn't think would let you bring food and drink, would let you bring stuff in. And then, yeah, some of the other places like Monza does for sure, Hockenheim, which I guess Hockenheim isn't even a track right at the moment, but Spa lets you bring in. I mean, you can camp at Spa, so obviously you can bring fire to the track.
Pretty much every European race you can bring in almost whatever you like.
Sometimes there's sticklers about glass bottles at European tracks, but other than that, I've never really seen any type of restrictions.
China, Malaysia, Singapore, you can bring in food. So I think it's just mostly a non-US thing.
That makes sense. I mean, you know, the US, we've got particular rules, and I totally get that. So the real reason we wanted to have you guys back on the podcast was really to talk about the Montreal Grand Prix experience. So Jeff, Joey, walk us through the race day experience as you guys experienced it, and some of the highlights that you really enjoyed, and some things perhaps that you might have done differently.
Yeah, so we stayed at the Hyatt Place, which was about a 2 mile walk from the track. That race day morning, we actually took an Uber to the bus depot. They had offsite buses, and then we took a bus to the casino entrance, which actually had almost no people at it versus. If we walked or took the subway, we would have had to have gone through the main entrance, which we had tried a couple days earlier. It was super busy. The casino entrance also put us a lot closer to our seats on the pit wall. We did hospitality for Sunday. Some basic food from the Fairmont, but I think we mentioned going back earlier too, like I actually like the seats we had with Trevor and Kay on Saturday in the PS Piastri Grandstand, I want to say. That might not be correct, but it's something very close to that. It's right next to the Piastri Grandstand.
The Platine Grandstand.
Oh, Platine. There we go. And that's like covered seats. You have a big screen. Hospitality was also pretty nice. Race got started around 1 p.m. local time. I think we went to the venue around 9:30, 10 o'clock. Got settled in. Yeah. And then it was a pretty decent race. It was somewhat uneventful. And then the two McLaren cars at the end crashed into each other right in front of our face. So that was a pretty race, which normally teammates aren't allowed to race each other. So that's a unique circumstance that happened. Kind of changed, shook up the race. It was pretty good. Otherwise, kind of an uneventful race. But the Canada Grand Prix is also really fast, which is nice, which can be unique. I think they get well up over 300 kilometers an hour, which is 180 miles an hour, give or take. We had our own bathrooms and hospitality. Like I said, we have our own catered food. They did run out of, I think, I don't drink alcohol, but Jeff, I think, ran out of wine and beer by the end of the day, which was unfortunate. Lots of Diet Coke and Zero, though, TK.
So I would have loved it. And yeah, having dedicated bathrooms, that sounds like quite the luxury compared to what we experienced.
The dedicated bathrooms were definitely pretty nice. That's the one downside of that grandstand we brought you guys to, that it didn't have a little bathroom. But it was a great experience. We ended up walking home after, which we did every day after the first day. Took about, I don't know, an hour and a half. Definitely consider going back and doing F1 Montreal.
Yeah, it sounds like you guys definitely had the right call for actual race day. I'm kind of disappointed we didn't get to experience the hospitality suite, but where we were, I definitely enjoyed. I know that Joey has already said that he would go back. Would you do another race, Jeff?
Yeah, I think I'd definitely go back. And honestly, I'd probably stay in the same place, especially if I was traveling like with my kid or something like that. He's a big motorsports fan. And both the cost and the location makes it pretty attractive for a relatively inexpensive F1 getaway. I mean, I think even including flights all in, we were still cheaper or on par with what we'd be paying to go to Austin or Miami. And I think it's probably an overall better event. I think that Montreal has it down pretty well after all these years. The logistics are good. The island is pretty cool. You know, if you hit on TK, even on Saturday, the vibe in the park, just being able to hang out and get away from everything track-related, it's kind of a nice benefit. So I would 100% go back.
And that says something, considering you were coming from the West Coast.
I appreciate motorsports, and I was really happy to have gone and be with you guys. I'm not sure I'm rushing back to Formula One anytime soon, but at the same time, I thought the experience in Canada and Montreal was pretty good. And I think a lot of things, you know, sometimes when you leave you leave the United States, you know, in some cases, Superior definitely felt like the way that particular racetrack laid out, the way that, you know, the amenities were available and you could bring you some drinks and food in, you know, there were a lot of things that I guess you wouldn't be able to do unless you were outside of the U.S. visiting F1. And so for that reason, I think definitely Montreal was a great option, but yeah, I'm not rushing back. Probably not going to be back immediately.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat. I think Montreal was a really good value, and for me, one of the best ways to sort of dip my toe into the Formula One experience, you know, actually arriving and attending some of the race activities. As everybody else has said, this Hyatt Place is wonderful. I mean, it's in a part of town that's transitioning, but it is a real quality hotel, and the location you just can't beat compared to where the track is.
Yeah, it's like right next to a transit hub, and they have. You can take the 747 bus from Trudeau Airport. So, you know, very convenient to mass transit, I will tell you.
So beautifully named airport bus, by the way. If I was going to do another race, I'd probably do something also overseas, but I'd probably go someplace like Baku, Azerbaijan. I know that, Jeff, we talked about that at one point or another. And so for some reason, that's put Baku on my radar.
Baku 2028, Trevor. I'm definitely down. I think we talked about it. I went to the inaugural race there, whenever it was, and had a good time. I would definitely go back. It's a very different city and very different experience, but I think it's probably a new destination for at least you to check off your list. And it's got a pretty good city. It's walkable. It's good hotels, and it was pretty inexpensive. It was fun.
Joey, any final thoughts as we transition to, or before we transition to dinner on the race?
I think my last couple of thoughts were just talking about a few things with the Hyatt Place. So I did some due diligence, got caught back up here. It's 12,000 points a night. There's two queen beds available seemingly year round. I don't know if they just have enough rooms. Max my point. They're showing 91% redemption available for pretty much two queen rooms, which I would essentially consider, I mean, most of the year. And then it was 955 Canadian a night, so it's right around 6 cents per point for F1. And we booked about a week before the race, which I think is a huge challenge. Now, you know, a lot of times for you to land some of these bigger events, you've got to be a year out and on top of things. And this Hyatt Place, I really struggled with in a lot of ways because it's probably nicer than a lot of Hyatt Regencies I've stayed at. It was very modern for itself. I know I think only one, because I got there a day before you guys. I checked out all the amenities, but there's a gorgeous like indoor marble pool, sauna, and spa in there. There's actually a really nice gym to go there as well. There was a Starbucks in the lobby. We had breakfast on the second floor, which, you know, I took, you know, because if you were a non-globalist, they were charging $7, I think. Seven Canadian, maybe, or seven US, 15 Canadian, whatever it is. And that did kind of irk me a little bit, but I wouldn't be discouraged staying here as a Hyatt Place. It's also right on top of the subway system, and there was a really full grocery store downstairs. It was built in 2021. It's got 351 guest rooms. So it's definitely, I think, on the newer side of Hyatt Places, and I was pretty impressed. Like, full marble bathroom, a lot of space, double vanity sinks, decent view. What did you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, it feels like, you know, outside of the U.S., it's like, it feels like a trend where, you know, sometimes these high places that are outside the U.S. are so nice, they kind of are pushing up against, you know, like the full service side. I mean, they're acting like they're a Hyatt Regency, you know, including charging for breakfast. But that they definitely seem to be punching above their weight class, which is not that uncommon with a lot of hotel chains, if you ask me. A lot of hotels, you know, you stay at a Four Points in the U.S., it's garbage. You know, you stay at a Four Points outside the U.S. and it's like, oh, this is kind of nice. This is where I don't mind staying, you know? So it seems to be following that trend.
Yeah, I definitely agree with all those points. So let's pivot to dinner. We were celebrating something on that dinner, weren't we?
Dare I say someone's birthday?
Yeah, and I think, Tom, you were the one that recommended the restaurant as well, right?
It was actually my third time to that restaurant, and kind of the that joke was that the last time I was there, I think I got caught gout after eating a meal there. So anyway, this was a pretty nice place. It's called Au Pied du Cochon. I learned about it watching Anthony Bourdain go there and having a great time, so that kind of inspired me to go. I think we had a pretty good time, and we definitely were given an awesome table for us, although it was a bit chilly back there. And the food generally I thought was really good. I thought there was one standout dish, and somebody wants to pick this up. Do you guys recall what the standout dish was?
Oh, it was like a sweet foie gras, like almost a creme brulee one. Was that the one?
It was definitely the item that was like mixed. It had maple syrup and foie gras. It was like, you know, had sweet and salty and umami, and you know, had all the taste going on. It was an appetizer, and I kind of regret we only ordered one.
Buckwheat pancake, bacon, cheddar, and a maple honey glaze.
That combination was amazing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then I thought poutine one was reasonably good as well. I feel like we had four different, if I recall, and I cannot remember the name of the other two. I thought it was great because we did enjoy family style with all the food and got to try a lot of different things. One of you guys wanted to get was it a duck in a can that came out really, really well.
That's actually something they're known for. The duck in a can is something they've had, I think, since they've opened, and it's one of their signature dishes. And you know, it's a little gimmicky. Basically, they stuff, you know, duck and foie gras and a bunch of other things in a can. They cook it, and then they open up the can at the table, and you're allowed to take the can with you as a souvenir. Although none of us did.
I liked that a lot, but when you consider the price is about $45 US, it is maybe a little maybe. But for people at home, it's inside your can is duck breast, raw cabbage, bacon, some puree, and brown butter. And it was really good, but I think the amount of meat you got for like horse was probably a little on the skimpy side.
That's probably pretty fair. I think we also had pork shank, I think.
That
was,
yeah, yep. That sounds right.
That was also pretty good. Yeah, I think the steak was the most expensive item we got. And I think it was the most disappointing because, I mean, it was the special of the night, and, you know, it was supposed to be like farm to table. Yeah, it wasn't particularly memorable. You know, it was just and not particularly tender or beefy, what I recall.
No, I was definitely a big fan of the foie gras with bacon and maple and the foie gras terrine.
Yeah, I'm usually a steak guy, and it did not hit the mark for me.
Oh, that was also very good, the foie gras terrine. Yeah. If you guys didn't haven't noticed, this is a very foie gras forward place. So, you know, if you don't like your duck liver, you're probably not going to have a great time eating here.
I thought it was a wonderful experience, and we were able to walk back. I mean, obviously, still referenced the earlier comment that we said that this is a neighborhood in transition. But I think it was only like a 10 or so minute walk back. And other than seeing an interesting looking Econo Lodge that looked like something else, nice and easy, not really a concern safety-wise, and kind of exactly what you needed after eating such a filling meal, such a rich filling meal like that.
Yeah. Definitely was probably, you know, I probably would have preferred to take an Uber, but under the circumstances after that richer meal, yeah, the walk back was a definitely a comforting thing to do.
So let's pivot to the last part of our trip. For one reason or another, I think we had all arranged to fly out of Toronto. I think the original idea was that we were going to fly into Billy Bishop, and we never did because the flights ended up being so expensive. So we ended up taking a different form of travel that I think we don't talk enough about on this podcast, and that was train.
Yeah, I think it was exciting. I mean, we kind of took the Qatar Q Suites of train travel. We managed to purchase a set of four seats in business class on Via Rail Canada. And if you get these certain particular seats, they are end up facing each other in a kind of a quad with a shared table. And it's kind of a cool, intimate place to spend a couple hours. This, as it turns out, 5-hour train trip between Montreal station and Toronto's main train station.
What's funny you mentioned Q-Suites, DK, is actually the trains, those new Via Rail trains, especially the business class cabins or cars, were actually designed by the same firm that did the Q-Suites. They're kind of a cool little Easter egg.
That would make a lot of sense, and they definitely have just as much style, I think, as, you know, Qatar Airways has. Just these happen to be terrestrial.
I thought the seats were great. They were super comfortable. We had lots of space, and even though we may have been a little obnoxious to the average Canadian business traveler, it was definitely a great experience to round off the trip.
Yeah, I kind of wonder what the guys who were sitting across from was like, why won't those dumb Americans shut up?
I think there were enough people leaving the race that they probably just assumed that, you know, they weren't going to have the great experience that they probably normally are used to. But yeah, the food was good. I thought the overall experience was good. The Wi-Fi was strong. Sometimes we take that for granted, but on trains, that's not always the case.
I mean, the Wi-Fi on the train is better than the Wi-Fi here in California, so it was a wonderful experience.
Just a public service announcement. AOL is turning off dial-up, so you might need to look for an alternative internet option, Jeff.
Ouch.
You know, it's tough out here in the I'll keep my comments to myself. But staying on topic here, you know, I think the biggest detriment that the group felt, or at least people, members of the group felt, was the dry nature of the train carriage until, I believe, it was 10 o'clock in the morning or 11 o'clock in the morning.
You know, it's funny that you bring that up. I mean, you know, people give it a big give a big deal when the Capital One Landing Lounge doesn't start serving alcohol until 7 a.m. I don't know what Dallas does with their blue laws on Sundays, but this was definitely one of those things. It's a Monday morning, even though they had a full bar. And as you get on, you see the full bar. And so you're thinking, oh, okay, you know, maybe I'll have something with my breakfast, a little mimosa or something. Nope, not happening until 10 a.m. And mind you, that's only like 2 hours left of the train.
I was going to say, that's relatively far into our trip.
And they also cut you off an hour before arrival, which was pretty brutal.
I mean, it's very efficient for the rail line because they really only have to serve an hour worth of adult beverages. That said, everything else was really good, and I think we got off still a little bit peckish because we all knew we had long trips, and grabbed a quick little bite at a nice little German, was it German beer garden? Not really a garden because it was in the train station, but it was that sort of an experience. Anyone have memories of that one?
I think I got the sausage sampler, which was I thought was really good. I'm trying to remember what else we got. Yeah, but definitely a lot of good German eats at that place. A really nice place to have lunch.
And then was it Joey? Were you the one that had remembered the rail connection to Toronto's Pearson Airport that was really, really convenient from that train station?
Yeah, just in general, because actually spent some time in Toronto on my way, and I hadn't been to Toronto in a little bit. And like one of the, I think, big key takeaways is you don't actually have to download money onto your Presto card now. You can just do tap to pay with any NFC phone. I thought it was an iPhone, but you know, whatever Jeff's ancient phone that he has, a Google Pixel 1 or whatever, it also seemed to work. So I guess any tap to pay phone, you could do that, which is cool because then you don't have to load the total into your transit card and then have, you know, money sitting in your transit card. You still get the rate that you would assuming that you had a card, which is cheaper.
This is the dump on Jeff's technology day.
Yeah, well, apologies. And I will say,
I feel like it's every day of my life, so it's okay.
In stark contrast, Montreal had no tap to pay, which made the trains there quite a pain.
Oh, that's a good point.
You had to go to
a
ticket booth and buy tickets. So Montreal definitely gets the win in that situation. But Toronto Union Station or Grand Central Station or whatever term they called it was really nice. And then from Montreal, the Toronto train dropped us off there. We had a meal. And then we hopped on the train straight to the airport, which I have to say was awesome.
Yeah, I don't think we had to go outside after we boarded our train, essentially.
That was very convenient. Didn't we have to do the almost Newark-style train to get to the terminal from where they dropped us off?
Yeah, so we took the, I think it's called the Up Express or the UPX, which is what takes you from Union to Pearson Airport. There's a charge to that. I don't know. It's relatively cheap and simple. I would recommend you do it at the airport. And then they have a different train that, yeah, just like EWR, that takes a terminal link, they call it, which takes you from each possible terminal link from terminal 1 to terminal 3, depending on where you're departing from.
The train situation in Toronto definitely seems to be miles ahead of Montreal, at least from a convenience perspective. You know, the tap to pay thing, like Joey mentioned, I think that would be a game changer in Montreal as far as the race was concerned. But with that inability to do so, the queues for the ticket lines were just, you know, half an hour to an hour long. So it was really nice to get to that Toronto Central Station and be able to literally run and just jump on the train.
Yeah, I think compared to what we're used to, like hopping on a train from, let's say, downtown or a train station in downtown, let's say, New York or downtown D.C., and trying to get to, like, let's say, Dulles Airport from Union Station, D.C., or getting from Penn Station and getting to, like, JFK, Toronto is 10 times easier than either of those transits.
By the time we got to Toronto, we all got through security one way or another. I won't say anything about who might have been a little bit slower than another, but we all were able to get into the American Lounge. It's nothing amazing. It is on the past global entry and everything, and it is a, you know, a comfortable place to you know, rest and compare versions of Diet Coke, I think, from the machine. Joey and Tom and and we did have.
I think we were trying out the diet root beer, if I remember.
Yeah, they had a freestyle machine, which the lounge is very small, and if we had arrived 10 minutes later, we wouldn't have had a place to sit. However, they had a Coke freestyle machine with quite a lot of options. I was very pleasantly surprised.
I think there was some taste
zero,
testing.
Which is you and your diet barks.
Yeah.
And they had diet barks, which bark zero. Not Diet Barks, Bark Zero, which is impossible to find in the United States.
In high demand.
For good reason.
For good reason.
I think that's sort of where we finished the trip. We all went our own separate ways. I know that Tom and I talked about our experience on another episode that I can't remember if we published yet or not.
I think we did.
I will throw a PSA out there for the listeners. You mentioned the struggles at Toronto security for some of us. If you are flying on the wonderful airline of Canada, be Porter Southwest, be sure you bring your global entry card. For some reason, do not recognize global entry for security and fast pass purposes without the card. Whereas I believe you guys flying American and whoever else had zero issues. So even with pre-check numbers and validation and all that good stuff, Porter wanted to see the physical card.
Wow. Although that's not the first time I think having a global entry card while you're in Canada has been a good thing. So I guess
it's usually suggested, especially if you're driving across the border.
They can't just see the global entry CBP sticker in the back of your passport? And that's not enough for them?
I think having the card is
good. I don't have a sticker, but probably the right thing to do is to have the card in general as a general rule of thumb. This is the first time I've actually been caught out and had dramas because of it.
Trevor, I don't want to point out the obvious here or, you know, throw stones, but there's a theme in this episode of one person having a lot of trouble.
You know, I'm taking a different memory or note from this, and I'm going to have to hunt down where the heck my global entry card is. My wife is smart enough to carry hers and our daughter's global entry cards. And that in fact has actually been very helpful because my daughter got her passport at like, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks old. And so she looks nothing like her picture as one would expect. And so the biometrics, it takes like we'll go a couple of times, the biometrics updates, and then it won't work. And then it will, then it won't. Great recommendation regardless on global entry cards. And we won't give Jeff too much hard of a time on the other travel challenges. So any final thoughts on our first international guys trip in, gosh, it must have been like, what, 6 years, 7 years?
Too long. You know, too long between trips, man.
Yeah, we got to do something sooner. We absolutely have to. And we've got to be more epic. We got to be more epic.
We set the bar kind of high. You know, that's the only problem.
I appreciate your fault, right? I really do appreciate you guys slumming it in Canada with me because, you know, I know your preference would have been 24 hours in Bali and then 6 hours in Jakarta. And return into Doha. So I thank you for staying in Canada for 3 days with me.
Well, we did find those really good airfares out of Montreal to, I think, was it to Bangkok and also to Denpasar Bali in business class on Qatar. We had found some pretty decent airfares. So, I mean, you know, we committed to Montreal. We were just, you know, a little bit more open on whether or not we were going to stay in Montreal. But happy we did. I think it was a great experience. And I don't think I'd want to go to a F1 race with anyone else but you guys.
I mean, who else would I want to share, you know, my time in Canada's best city, you know?
Oh, the best city of them all. Up north.
Had to get that in there at the end. Huh?
Well, hopefully we'll do it next time, but we'll be able to do the real Q suites and have the quad. That's something I haven't been able to fly, you know, with three other guests on Qatar Airways. So maybe that'll be something we do next time.
Definitely a goal. Definitely a goal.
I look forward to it. I will definitely say that, you know, guys' trips, once you have families, becomes a lot more valuable. So it was much appreciated to reconnect.
Yeah, such a great time.
Totally agree.